You're listening to Trek FM.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
The day I went missing was the day I died. 5 years in hell forged me into a weapon, which I used to honor a vow I made to my father, who sacrificed his life for mine. In his final moments, he told me the truth, that our family's wealth had been built on the suffering of others, that he failed our city, and that it was up to me to save it and right his wrongs. But to do that without endangering the people closest to me, I have to be someone else. I have to be something else.
Welcome, everyone, to Trek FM's local watering hole, where I'm your host, Matthew Rushing, and you have failed this show. That's right, you have failed. I'm just kidding, guys. I'm sorry.
Oh,
I apologize.
God.
I got really excited. Been watching way too much Arrow, apparently, recently. You have not failed this show. You have done exactly what you're supposed to do, and you have tuned in, and so congratulations. And I hope you got something great from Ruby, because we do have a really fun show for you this week. Before we get to that, I do want to introduce who's joining me in the 602. First and foremost, it is great to have back here in the 602 Club, Alice from Educating Geeks. Alice, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. Glad to join you here at the bar.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm glad you could be here too, because, well, it would have just felt weird if Daniel and I were the only one talking about Stephen Amell's abs.
Indeed, I understand that.
Yeah, so I'm glad that we have a lady, so it feels a little less strange. Anyway, Daniel, it's great to have you back in the 602 to talk some Arrow.
Yeah, no, I'm glad to be here, and, you know, honestly, If you wanted to do a separate podcast just about Stephen Amell's abs, I would actually volunteer for that one as well. So
there you go, supplemental podcast about Stephen Amell's abs.
Yeah.
Maybe coming to you soon. We might have to make that the Trek FM After Dark show,
because
who knows where that one would go.
Yeah.
but as you can tell, we are here to talk about Arrow, and we are going to start going through some of these shows like this through the seasons, and we wanted to start here with season one with Arrow, and I wanted to kind of start with you guys, you know, returning to the and remembering the beginning of this show, because, you know, I grew up watching all of Smallville. I remember when it started. You know, that was kind of my first introduction. I kind of missed the Lois and Clark run. You know, there was something about it. I love Superman, but that just didn't seem like my thing. But, you know, the whole idea of doing Superman as a teenager, that it wasn't going to be about him flying around and saving, it was a whole new take. And that show ran for 10 years. Apparently, if you're on the CW and you're a show like that, I mean, we've got Supernatural now. What is it? It's an 11th season or something.
It's about to break Smallville's record, because Smallville now has the record for, like, best, longest running sci-fi television show ever, and Supernatural's going to break it. So
I'm just wondering for you guys, you know, back when it was 3 years ago now that Arrow first started, where were you kind of in your state of mind that made you be like, oh, I want to tune in to this show? Because it for me, it kind of came out of nowhere. You know, we didn't have any other superhero shows on. You know, this wasn't a thing. And Arrow kind of bursts on the scene. And, I mean, I knew I was going to tune in, but I kind of wanted to hear what brought you guys in, Alice.
I am a longtime lover of the Green Arrow comic, and so I was excited to see what they were going to do with that. I thought I would, you know, I have many editions of Green Arrow going back to the 40s, actually. Obviously, I don't own any first editions or anything, like, they're all collected works, but I really love that character. He's probably my favorite DC character, so I was just excited to see what they were going to do with it, and you know, how closely they were going to follow some of the tent poles of the canon and how they were going to, you know, come away from that and what was going to be the same, what was going to be different, and all that kind of stuff. So because I was already a fan of the character, that's why I wanted to tune in.
What about you, Daniel?
You know, I'm glad you brought up Smallville because, and maybe you didn't reach this point, Matthew, I don't know if you watched the whole run or not, but season 7, I want to say, or season 8. They introduced Oliver Queen Green Arrow as
they
a character
did, yeah.
on that show, yeah. And, I mean, you know, I was aware that he existed beforehand, but not interested in the character. And honestly, even after Smallville, was like, meh, this guy is running around with a bow and arrow. I don't really care that much, honestly. Actually,
kinda
I was...
like Hawkeye.
I was... like Hawkeye, right, exactly. I was actually a little upset because... Lois Lane was going for him on that show, and that really irritated me because I really wanted her. Anyways, that doesn't matter. It has no bearing on this.
We'll do our Smallville show.
Yes, it does, actually.
So I remember hearing, like, once Smallville was coming to an end, that they were thinking about doing something else, and then they settled on Arrow, and I was like, I kind of dismiss Hawkeye for the same reasons that I dismiss Green Arrow. I just think that they don't, in that kind of a universe, and Hawkeye directly addresses this in Age of Ultron, where he says, you know, this is silly. This is ridiculous. I shouldn't be. I have a bow and arrow and I'm shooting robots and stuff. So I always dismiss these characters out of hand. And so I didn't really have any interest at the time when it first came out. But then it was actually starting to build a lot of really positive buzz. I remember reading article after article, like, why Arrow is the best show you're not watching. And like, this show is amazing. This is great. So I was actually, I think I caught up midway through season 2. I was... when I finally binge-watched the whole first season. So I actually did ignore the show for the majority of the first season.
Well, I remember I watched all of Smallville, and I really loved the use of Green Arrow on the show. I thought he was a nice foil for Clark on the show. I loved just the whole dynamic. I mean, in the end, they kind of created their own Justice League, and it was so much fun. And very much what they're doing with all of the DC shows now. They're creating their own Justice League on TV, and Smallville did it, you know, in that 10-year run. But when this came out, I was really excited because, you know, we had had Nolan's Batman, and for me, that really reignited a love of what superheroes could be, you know, in media. You know, for me, that was the thing I think that really got me excited again. I loved Iron Man 2 as well. Not Iron Man 2, the movie, but Iron Man as well as Batman and the Dark Knight trilogy that they did. And so those things put together, you know, when I saw that Arrow was going to be coming out, I thought, this is the same, you know, network that gave me Smallville. I loved Smallville for 10 years. I stuck with it. I ended up feeling like I was paid off. So I'm super pumped that they're going to do another one. And... in the end, I mean, what I got was a pseudo Batman on TV, you know, and they even talk about that. They're freely open with that on the extras. You know, if you watch the Blu-rays these days, look, we kind of took some of that idea of Batman Begins and basically are doing that with the Arrow character, which, you know, it's always fun to kind of get the year zero or the year one of a character. And so bringing this person in too that people have in the background of their minds but may not be as familiar with, I think was genius as well. Because, you know, with Smallville, they did this wonderful thing where they took the character and they made the DC universe into their image, what they wanted their show to be. And each of the DC shows, I think, has really done that successively. And they've done it well. You know, Flash is doing the same thing with the Flash. Arrow does the same thing with the Green Arrow. I'm pretty sure that Supergirl is going to do the same thing. They amalgamate the character from all the different personalities that they've been in comics for, you know, 70 years or whatnot. And they put their version on screen. And I love that. And to me, I thought Arrow was the greatest show ever. I mean, that's how I felt, you know, when I throughout the first season. If people were watching it, I was like, you need to be watching Arrow. It's so good. And people would give me that being like, dude, it's just a comic book show, you know. But and then people would watch it and they'd be like, oh, that's really good, you know. So it just blew my mind when it came on TV, because we really didn't have anything like this, you know, 3-4 years ago. This wasn't what we were doing. And I think in the end, what they're able to do on the show with their CW budget is pretty incredible. I mean, every once in a while, the show could look cheesy, but that's just because, you know, you can't afford ILM to do your graphics, you know, and I just let that go. So,
well, that's actually one of the brilliant things about doing a character like Green Arrow, where you don't necessarily need to do crazy, super awesome special effects. Basically, what you need is a guy with washboard abs sliding down, you know, a zip line, and there you go. There's your special effects. It's not like someone like Superman, or even the Flash, which we get now, where, you know, to start out with that kind of grounded character, that Batman-esque character, I think makes it it puts it in an area that makes it easier to kind of establish that kind of a universe in.
I would definitely agree. I think it's interesting that you said it's great to have a year one on a character, because there is a Green Arrow graphic novel called Year One by Diggle, which I think is a nod to that character name, which is essentially where they pulled a lot of the look and the feel and the storyline for the island scenes from. But, you know, as we all laugh about how gorgeous Stephen Amell's abs are, one of the things that I really enjoyed about season one especially, and I remembered rewatching it, was he gives this really, the reason why I was happy with the show primarily when it first started and continued to watch it, was because of the performance that he gives. Yes, he's great to look at, but he gives this really beautifully subtle, very nuanced performance as Oliver Queen, and I really, really enjoyed that and was drawn in by his performance. And really, that's the main reason why I stuck with the show initially.
Well, and I think you just hit on something that is really important about this show, is that not only are the writers crafting one show, but this is two shows in one. Every week, they're giving you the island show, and they're giving you what's happening now show. And they have to find a way to make all of that work and make it feel realistic, make it feel like it all fits, make it feel like everything is working in concert together and that they have a plan. And that's got to, I mean, seriously, if the Lost writers had written like this, and this was the mystery of the island and Lost, I would have been much happier. I mean, the fact that they understand that they're crafting a larger story and seem to be hammering out these details before they go into the season, this is a massive amount of work to put in and create really two different shows every year. And as we will talk in future episodes, you know, in season two, it's not just the island, but it's you know, you start to move to other places that Oliver has traveled when he was gone. And so it gets really complicated really fast. And the fact that they can keep track of this, they must have the most massive Excel spreadsheet on the planet. That are the most amazing wall flowchart that's probably like a mile long, because connecting, or they just look like those, you know how like superheroes, they always like to do those nice collages on the wall with all the string attached everywhere that doesn't really make any sense to the viewer. Pretty sure that's what the writer's room for Arrow looks like.
them are serial killers, one or the other.
Yeah.
And I would have to say, Matthew, I do believe that it is the Doctor Who showrunners that have the largest Excel spreadsheet for any show. Just
that's probably
that
true, yeah.
You know, especially in this first season here, I am not one that likes these kind of jumping around kind of things. I thought it was done incredibly well. Like, I was actually just as... because it's difficult to create drama in a situation where you know the character has already escaped, is already out of this situation now. But that's not what it's about. It's not like, oh my goodness, is Oliver going to make it? It's more about, what is it about this experience that shaped him into the person that he returned as? And, like I said, especially in that first season, it's so well-crafted and so well... the themes are so well interwoven episode by episode by what's going on in the island and then what's going on back in Star City.
Starling,
I was
going to
say Central City, and I knew that wasn't right. so it's really awesome, and I really was actually surprised to find, except for, and I think it's very important that we mention this, the god-awful wig that they make Stephen Amell wear when he is on the island. Like, it is so bad. Like, it, oh my goodness. It looks like he's wearing, it's just the worst.
Maybe
it's
it can worst. Have its own show.
It like, probably could.
Its own supplemental where we just talk about how bad the wig is.
It's like,
It's bad, but I will say that it did succeed in making his face look chubby, which was appropriate.
That is very true. That is
right?
True. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing that I think is really so successful about the show. And the thing that was so that's so okay. important about the show is what you were talking about, is that the flashbacks, if you're going to do flashbacks in a show, you need to work it in from the very beginning, because otherwise flashbacks tend to be a very terrible writing device. It is a horrible crutch to go back and kind of retcon yourself to explain a situation so much of the time. But the thing that I've loved about what DC did from the very beginning was to say, this is two different shows in some ways, that's informing you how our character gets to this point. So it makes, like you said, what's happening on the island so paramount, because it's the refining fire for Oliver Queen. You know, what makes him who he is when he goes home. And in some ways, too, it causes a lot of the problems when he comes home as well. You know, so it's not like he just became Superman in the Fortress of Solitude for 12 years and comes out, you know, the consummate hero. You know, Oliver comes out of this like the one of the most damaged, disturbed people, even more so, I think, than what we see sometimes with Batman, you know, in his experience. Oliver has a worse time of this, I think, than it, even say like Bruce Wayne in the Nolan universe, you know, because he chooses that life. He chooses to go to those places. Oliver Queen did not choose to get stuck on this island because of his mother, you know? So, I mean, we'll talk about that later, but this is what makes this so successful though, is that they really set the foundation for creating this show. So when they go back to the island to tell you something, it doesn't feel like it's just a crutch to do it. You know, this is the fabric of the show. And I think that's really smart, and they're really using that too with the Flash as well, because they've learned that if you're going to do flashbacks, make sure that the audience will buy it as realistic and not do the whole, you know, I hate to knock S.H.I.E.L.D., but when S.H.I.E.L.D. does the flashbacks, it's like, oh, you guys are just retconning yourself right now so bad. It's terrible.
Yeah, they do a nice job, I feel, in the use of the flashbacks also to tie it very specifically to a choice or a decision that Oliver Queen is about to make. So you'll see him in a situation talking to a character on the verge of having to make a decision, and then they'll take you back to something that's going to form or shape what you're about to see him, you know, the decision he's about to make. And I'm so glad that you mentioned S.H.I.E.L.D., because, right, they started at the same time, right?
S.H.I.E.L.D. came on one season later. So Arrow was in season two, and then S.H.I.E.L.D. came on. So, they're very close, though.
Because in my choice between watching Arrow and watching S.H.I.E.L.D., one of the things, I picked Arrow. And one of the reasons why I did that is because Arrow was grounding me, as you guys have already said, in this very specific world that was created, and those were the characters we were caring about. As we'll talk about in future shows, they start introducing more and more characters. But S.H.I.E.L.D. to me very much felt like, I don't know what words I'm allowed to use on this show, felt very self-fulfilling, back-rubbing, congratulatory, self-congratulatory for the Marvel universe, and that they kept pulling in, you know, characters from the movie and characters from somewhere else. It kept causing me to not care as much about the core team that was there. I was like, tell me the story about these people and make me care about them. I don't care if Lady Sif comes in. I don't care if Loki comes in. I don't care about those characters in this universe. I want to care about these characters. And
man,
I don't think Marvel did that very well.
Crushed it. Oh my gosh. You just said exactly how I feel about S.H.I.E.L.D. because I they keep taking away my desire to care for the characters on TV because they keep showing me how irrelevant they really are to the actual Marvel universe, because the movies happen and the TV show happens. And even Joss Whedon said, we don't really pay attention. So, right. You know, it's like, well, okay. Anyway, back to Arrow great it is.
I do. Well, I one slight criticism, and this isn't... It only becomes apparent on a rewatch or probably later on in the seasons, but while I do like the parallels of what's going on, like Alice was just saying about, like, oh, there's a decision he has to make, and then it flashes back to a relevant situation on the island, once they go back to that well over and over again, it seems really convenient that chronologically all of his experiences prepared him for all of the same experiences chronologically when he returned, and... It's not so bad in this season, but you can see the potential for the writers to kind of abuse that, to be like, oh, now he's involved in this super specific situation. I certainly hope the next thing that he has in his memory from 5 years ago is this exact same situation where he could have learned something valuable. And, it just a slight criticism. In the first season, it's not too bad because they didn't abuse it so much, but you can kind of see the seeds of that kind of abuse that takes place a little bit.
You're right, and yeah, that is one of the things that in the other seasons is kind of interesting, because there are some times where actually the island show or the away show has more play than what's happening, because that story is a little bit more important at that moment, which is always really interesting. And so yeah, they I think that's where I just really want to give these writers credit, especially here in this first season, is they are walking one of the hardest tightropes to do in television, which is to tell a story like this, and that they are having to tell two different show stories and make it seem like it's one at the same time, and not do what you just said, Daniel, which is make you just pull out of the show and be like, that's ridiculous. You know, So I think that's where we're giving them credit, though, that for the most part, throughout even all the seasons that I've seen through three, I don't feel like that's happening. And it's what's kept me going back over and over to Arrow and sticking with it, even when, you know, just as every show, there's a couple of stinkers every season. It happens to every show. And so you, especially even when you're doing, 22, 23 episodes, it's going to happen. So
I was just going to say that, I believe it's Andrew Kreisberg, who's one of the showrunners, mm-hmm. who also worked on Fringe, had that world duality aspect to it. And so perhaps some of his experiences working on Fringe helped inform him to be able to do that well on this show as well.
Oh yeah, I would think so, and especially kind of seeing the things that worked well for them on Fringe and maybe the things that didn't as well, to be able to pull that all together. I think you're really right. So, well, you had kind of touched on it, Allison, and I kind of want to just kind of dive into the actual characters and the people that we have playing with them, because I think this became the main strength of the show wasn't just the storylines that we got, but it was actually the actors, because as we said, some of the episodes might kind of be stinkers as an episode, but if you have good actors, they can pull you through. My wife and I are watching Friday Night Lights right now, and in the fourth season two's really not very good. The writer's strike happened to them, and some of the storylines just but the strength of the actors still made you care, which is a really hard thing. So first and foremost, our Oliver Queen, our Arrow, Stephen Amell, does he pull it off? Does he make you believe that this is the Green Arrow? Or excuse me, just the Arrow, or the Vigilante, or the Hood, whatever we want to call him tonight.
We should actually distinguish.
Will the real... Oliver Queen, please stand up.
I actually think that's an important distinction, because I actually kind of feel like, I don't know if they have an end game in mind, but either the writers are planning on the final episode, him taking up that moniker, or some really massive event, and I think that's actually kind of important. Like you said, if this is a year zero or year one kind of a story, this idea that he doesn't take this name, it's just given to him, but eventually he will take ownership of it and he will become that character is something that's super interesting to me. That's a bit of an aside. And real quick, I will tell you that the first person that I ever heard that watched this show was my sister. You know, a 34-year-old mother of two. And she's like, you've got to watch this show. It's so awesome. And I'm like, all right. She's like, it's Arrow. And this guy has got like 10 abs. And I'm like, all right, that's not really a selling point for me, but I'll check it out if it's that good. I mean, besides the physicality that he brings to the role, which is obviously extremely important for you to believe it. I think he's a great actor. And as a side, a little side note, very excited to see him as Casey Jones in the next two Ninja Turtles.
He's too good looking to be Casey Jones.
But he's behind a mask the whole time, so it doesn't matter.
All right, whatever.
And he's gonna kiss Megan Fox. So I mean, who cares at that point? Like, it's so ridiculous. But
yeah, I do think that he gives a wonderfully subtle performance most of the time. Just like you pointed out, Matthew, he's not perfect all the time. Nobody is. And there are definitely moments where he isn't quite working for me as much as I'd like him to. But good 90-95% of the time, he's totally believable to me as that character. And I think his immediate Scooby Gang in Felicity Smoke and Diggle also put in very good performances, especially, oh my God, what is her name? Emily
Beckett Richards.
Thank you very much. Who plays Felicity? I think, and I knew nothing of her beforehand. And to me, it's one of those moments where this character comes in, and I don't even know if she was really intended to or meant to become such a pivotal person in the show, but comes in and does such a great job that, you know, America fell in love with her, you know, kind of a thing, because she really just puts in such a great performance.
Yeah, I have such a nerd crush on her. Like, oh my goodness. And I imagine that you're right. I bet you there's a backstory where, like, she came in for that one episode and like that chemistry was there and she was so good for that role. Like, oh man, like to me, she's my favorite character on the show by far. There's not even a second place that's even close to her. She's so awesome.
Well, there's nothing like Felicity sticking her foot in her mouth five times in like 3 seconds.
That every time she meets somebody new, every single time. It's awesome. Awesome.
Yeah, I'm with you, Daniel. She is really one of my favorite parts of the show. And the way that she plays off Steven, you know, they have such great chemistry in that they, you know, he's the straight man and she's just the bumbling geek. And of course, she also has that crush on him because of those aforementioned abs. And I mean, we all kind of have a crush on him because of those abs. But anyway, It just works so well. And I think one of the things that I really love about Steven is the fact that when he's playing younger Oliver in those situations on the island, he really plays it so well. I mean, he is that jackass that just, like, he's the playboy that could care less. Everybody serve me. Everything is about me. You know, and I mean, he's the epitome of everything that's wrong in America about people, you know, at that point. And to watch him slowly be, you know, beaten into what he becomes every time. I mean, and how hard must that be for Stephen Amell to play that? Because anytime they jump back in time, he has to play that like he did the last time he was in a scene during that time period. And, you know, so that's a really hard thing to do. And the fact that he just nails it almost every time, like you said, Alice, there's some times where it's not perfect, but almost every time, that's good enough, you know. And I just rewatched the show with my wife, season 1 and 2, and I was really picking up on just what he was laying down. I was impressed again by just how well he does. And I think you guys are right. The triumvirate of him and Dave Ramsey is John Diggle and Emily Bette Richards as Felicity Smoke. It's really those three, you know, that trinity that we care about so much and how they've all grown together. And I love that John Diggle is
his conscience.
The Jiminy Cricket for the Arrow, you know, and the ways in which, too, that him and sometimes Oliver switch places with that, you know, when it comes to the Deadshot stuff. And right. Oliver has to kind of be that for him. And the way they're basically the proverb of iron sharpening iron, so one man sharpens another, that's Diggle, and that's Oliver. I love that. And
of course, Felicity's the whetstone.
That is true. Yeah. And the fact that she's there, I mean, without her, they wouldn't still be a team. You know?
For sure.
That's what makes her so pivotal.
I love that scene where she goes, you know, after they have their spat, their bromance spat. And she goes to Diggle's apartment and basically, you know, apologizes for Oliver. And I love that scene. And yeah. Diggle's response is, well, I need to hear it from him, essentially. You know, like, you're not good. I loved that whole dynamic when that bromance spat happened. I really enjoyed that.
What did you guys think about the Borg Queen for a mother? Because Susanna Thompson played the Borg Queen in the Dark Frontier mini movie that they did with Voyager, because they couldn't get Alice Kriga to be back, and so Susanna Thompson had filled in the role. And I remember the first time that I saw her on the show, I was like, that's the Borg Queen, which immediately told me there's something that's going to be wrong about her from the very beginning, because I was like, she cannot be a good mother.
There were times for me where, and I don't know if it was her or the writing or some combination thereof, but a little bit of her stum and drum around, you know, not for my children. I'm only doing it for my children. There were times where I was not buying that from her delivery at all. And I was just like, ugh, rolling my eyes kind of a thing. So I don't know, as a performance and as a character, that wasn't one of the stronger ones for me personally.
You know, I don't know. I never really landed on like where I thought about her. I kind of was always like, she's there. She's an element of the show. I guess she knows things that I should care about, but I don't really care so much about what she thinks about things, if that makes any sense. She was never compelling enough to be really that interested in, other than the fact that, hey, I'm Oliver's mom, and I was also at some point involved with these people, and then it's, you know, my husband died. I don't know. I just, not exactly the best character of the show, I would say.
I liked that once I found out that John Barrowman, who plays Malcolm Woo-hoo. Merlin, of course, also Captain Jack Harkness from Doctor Who.
Face of Bo.
And I, I love that he is just maniacally evil here, and you get none of that Captain Jack Harkness feel. It's just like, and what I loved is that when they went together, you know, him and Moira, you know, when you realize what she's been up against, I did understand, okay, she is worried for her kids and their life, you know, because he will kill anybody. He doesn't care, you know. So it was an interesting thing. I don't know. I personally like Susanna Thompson most of the time on the show. I think sometimes that's a little bit too melodramatic, and she plays it a little bit more like that sometimes. But on a whole, everything about the show and all of the actors, they work so well together that when one of them isn't like at the top of their game, I feel like the other person in the scene is usually helping bring it up. And, you know, John Barrowman is just fantastic, and he made a great first year villain. Because especially too, I mean, he has the connections with everybody there, with Tommy, the best friend, you know, being his father, and all of this, and them having grown up together, as families. I loved that they chose that storyline, because I think, one, it works, and two, he just nails it.
Yeah. I enjoyed him as a villain, and I think that my enjoyment of him, as you mentioned, is somewhat colored by the fact that he, you know, acts and plays a character so different from, you know, the beloved and charming and hysterical Captain Jack Harkness, that, you know, his performance stands out, I think, for me or anyone who has enjoyed Captain Jack.
Who hasn't enjoyed Captain Jack?
good job, I mean, man. Like, great acting. Like, you're not a one-trick pony. Awesome.
For some reason in my head, I compare John Barrowman and Nathan Fillion. And I don't know what it is about them, but I kind of see them as, I don't know, you know, kind of the same people in a lot of ways. I don't know what it is. Like, they play geek culture icons, and they're both charming as hell, and they both
funny.
And they're funny, and they can just, to me, like, they could do anything. I mean, like, it's hard to compare Merlin with Captain Hammer, but they both play a villain, and they both do it really, really well. And I just feel like there's nothing that John Barrowman could do where I wouldn't be like, okay, I'm on board. You know, you've sold me 1,000 years ago, man. You can do whatever you want.
Well, and he only continues to get more interesting as the seasons move on, too, which is
true.
Makes for just a fantastic character as well, is that they don't just make him one note. And that's something you can really do with your villains. And I mean, gosh, Manu Bennett, who plays Slade Wilson, the fact that, you know, we don't know anything he's going to be in season two when we're watching this, but man, that dude is awesome. I mean, as a Australian security secret service dude, I mean, I don't want to mess with that guy.
I think the term is badass.
Yeah, he is bad to the bone.
But isn't he just in season two? Right?
He's in season one and two.
Okay, yeah. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I knew this was gonna happen. It was gonna mix in my head. So,
yeah. He's the guy.
Oh,
who
he was
begins.
Nice. He was super nice in the beginning.
Yes, right? Yes, exactly. He's the one who begins his training, essentially.
Right.
On the island.
And if the show didn't have enough abs already, now we have extra abs to add on to the abs that we already have.
Yeah, pretty much all the men on that show have great abs.
Exactly. Well, and then, of course, you know, we have Shadow on the island, which I don't know who didn't fall in love with Shadow, too, because she was so amazingly awesome. I just have to say, Arrow, I think, is kind of rife with really strong female characters that they don't always end up in the forefront. But I feel like they never let off just being like the damsels in distress all the time. And if they are in the beginning, they're always growing towards something different. You know, even like Felicity and her, just how she grows in this first season, you know, and she becomes even more involved with what they do and so integral to what they do that if there was no Felicity, they can't do what they do. You know, when they try to do it without her, it usually ends pretty badly.
She's like the Mystique of the Marvel Universe.
Exactly. Yeah. I love that. What did you guys think of Thea and Laurel Lance, especially in this first season?
Oh boy.
silent.
yeah.
Should I just insert crickets there?
Okay. Yeah, so I guess I'll start first and say some quick things, and then I'll let Alice go because maybe she has some stuff to say as well. Thea, to me, is, especially in the first season, kind of bland and boring. She plays the little bratty sister role pretty well, I guess, but it doesn't add necessarily a whole lot, which is fine. I guess it doesn't have to. But what I more have a problem with is Laurel. And I will say this without apology, I hate the character of Laurel. It seems like we talked about Smallville earlier, Matt, and I hated Lana throughout the whole show. I wished she got off and the show got better for me when she left the show. And no offense to the actress playing Laurel. I don't know if it's her or the character, how it's written. She plays the exact same role that Lana played in Smallville to me, whereas they put this character in as a romantic interest, and then they try to turn them into something else, something more interesting, and it just falls flat on its face. It just doesn't work. She's the most frustrating part of this show for me, and maybe I feel more strongly than most people, and that's okay. But I think it's partly portrayal and partly writing. I just never buy her as a legitimate interest for Oliver. I never, you know, as terrible as, I'm not even going to say it. I don't like her as a character. So I wish she was gone. I wish she was just a season one memory, I guess I should say.
Yeah, I would say, I don't think my reactions are quite as strong, but Thea doesn't feel to have a lot of weight as a character in the series. For me, other than, as Daniel said, the bratty kid sister, really she plays sort of like a subconscious to both her older brother and her mom. You know, she's the one who comes in and will say the things like, well, then, you know, don't you care about when I come home at night? You should be a better mom, kind of a thing. You know, she has those kinds of lines, which sometimes are interesting and sometimes just fall really flat. And again, those are sort of the eye roll moments. For me, she is sort of a nod to a comic book character, which I appreciate. But until if we continue this series, she gets a little bit more weight and a little bit more to do. She doesn't feel very weighty, I guess is the way that I would say it. Laurel, I have similar problems with, and I actually know a lot of people who have similar problems with Laurel. Green Arrow ending up with Black Canary is one of those tent poles of the canon that I have some attachment to just as a fan. And it's hard for me to imagine her as Black Canary in season one, perhaps in other seasons as well, but we're talking about season one. And so it was challenging. And even though the guys in the show do as much melodrama around the freaking relationship, well, I can't believe that you slept with my sister. Well, I can't believe you slept with my girlfriend's brother. Well, I can't believe that you were like making out with my ex who was my girlfriend's brother, blah, 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 blah. I mean, the boys do that as much as the girls do in this show. But for some reason, when she does it, it just, well, it's like nails on a chalkboard for me. And I don't know. You know, I feel like such a traitor to my sex by saying that, but she in this season especially just scrapes me the wrong way.
Well, hey, you feel your feels. You know, you don't apologize for how you feel about a character. And I, you know, I think just having rewatched the season, I was surprised that they both came off better than I remembered because I remembered them being kind of like, you know. But I think too, it was this is that I think with both of those characters, they've had a long game and they needed them to kind of start off at a place that was a shade unlikable and then they're going to bring them forward because I think really by the time you get to season three and the very end of it, the characters are in completely opposite places. Both, Thea and both Thea and Laurel are in very different spots, and it'll be interesting because I think if they continue to grow in that manner, people will remember it differently when they say rewatch the show because they'll see the progression. But I think these characters specifically, both of them are really long game characters that they kind of have mapped out. Okay, this is what we're going to do with them in season one, season two, season three, and on. And yeah, they kind of start off as those whinier characters and everything. But what I liked about the Thea character wasn't so much who played her or how she was played. I actually like Willa Holland a lot, who plays Thea, but I really liked what she was to Oliver. And, you know, for him, it was all about trying to protect his sister and keep her out of it and try and give her the life that he doesn't have. And realizing in the end, and this goes to all the other seasons, but that's not what she needed, you know? And the goal to sometimes protect people, we can end up hurting people instead. And so, I just liked it that story starts here, but it actually doesn't even get played out really all the way till the end of the third season. So when they're in a completely different place. So I'm with you guys. Those are the characters that it's harder to get into, but I especially too liked when Colton Haynes comes on the show as Roy, and I really
also
like
great
him.
Abs.
Great also abs, great of course. Abs.
Yeah, it's and he, the way he plays that character, I think just you immediately kind of feel for the guy. You know, a character that is a little bit cliched. You know, he's from the wrong side of the tracks, and he falls in love with the hot girl that's from the right side of the tracks, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But the way that he plays it, it kind of makes you buy it. So I have to give him a lot of credit for all of these characters taking these really melodramatic things that are happening for the most part and making you, like, buy it instead of just being like, oh my God, get over it. You know, like, that's how I felt for, you know, Smallville with Lana. I was with you, Daniel. By, like, season three, I was like, dude, shut it. I don't care that Clark won't tell you about himself, okay? It's for your own good. You know it. Anyway.
So can I just real quick, one thing I want to mention, especially since Alice mentioned that she was such a huge fan of the character, and from someone like me who's coming vanilla at this, like super vanilla, I remember, especially when I was watching the first season and you know, Roy comes in and it's like, oh, we don't know who's Roy going to be. You know, he calls his sister Speedy, but there's also Arsenal. There's also the Red Arrow. Like, it was really interesting to me to be like, first of all, I didn't even know these other characters existed. Like, Green Arrow needs to have a sidekick? Like, another guy that shoots a bow and arrow? Like, what's the point of it? But I also actually really grew to like that character a lot. I really, really like him. And it was interesting to see how they're kind of, I don't know if they have a long-term plan or they don't or whatever, but it's working out really well, like how these characters kind of interweave and change and grow and leave and come back and all of this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I would. So, you know, Speedy is his, you know, much like Batman and Robin, right, back in the 40s when it started. But I feel like for the most part, that's one of the things that I appreciate about Arrow is its commitment to just being a good story mixed with its commitment to what has come before it. And I think when you're delving into a fandom like a DC world or a Marvel world or Lord of the Rings or whatever, you can't, you know, it's not like you can say, well, Legolas, I never liked that character. You know, we'll just have it be the Fellowship of the Eight, you know, and decide to leave him out. You know, I mean, like, you have to pay some homage to what has come before you. And I feel like the show does a really nice job of really being its own, which I know is something that you talk about a lot, Matthew, and that you don't necessarily need that, but you need the show to be, you know, cohesive in its own world. I need a show to be that, but to also be aware of and be respectful of where it's coming from. And I feel like Arrow does that really well with nods like talking about Speedy or Arsenal or having Thea be an amalgamation of characters that I can figure out where they're coming from. And I think from a fandom perspective, DC really got that right with the show because of all the people who really love the comics can key into that stuff and see it without it being a really obvious take on it, which I think was just really, really smart of them.
I think you just hit on something really beautiful, and it's what DC has been doing, is that tell your story, you know, and what DC did for the TV universe is, unlike the shackles that it really put on Smallville, what they could and couldn't do, what they could and couldn't use, the majority of the toy box is there to play with. You know, they get to pull out all the toys and do pretty much whatever they want with them, and almost nothing is off limits. You know, I think really probably the only thing might be maybe Batman, but they, you know, that might get a mention sometime too, because Supergirl's about to come out, and whether or not we see Superman play a large part, we at least see him in silhouette. So, I mean he's a part of the and he's a part of that universe.
Yeah,
he's a part of the universe. So, I think that's really, really smart that, unlike Marvel, who's like, it's all connected, so our movies and our TV all has to be connected. No, the TV universe gets to play with all the toys. The movie universe gets to play with all the toys. And really, basically, we just get an awesome double dipping of, you know, and really, in the end, what this feels like, this is Earth 2, and that's the Prime Earth, you know, on the films. And it's awesome because we all still care about Earth 2 in the comics. You know, or Earth One, you know, what they've been doing with the Earth One for series for DC. So I think their understanding of the multi-universe has really helped them in a way that Marvel hasn't quite captured yet. And that's been a huge success for them, I think, is that storytelling. And it started back in some ways with Smallville, of them having to make things up and fit for them in a way that worked on their show. And they brought that forward, that lesson, and they just ran with it with Arrow and now with Flash and everything else. So,
real quick, Matthew, you haven't had a chance to watch Supergirl, the pilot, have you?
No, I refused to watch it. I'm firmly supporting the show, and I'm waiting till it comes out.
Okay, fair enough, officially. And I'm not spoiling anything by saying this, but they say it's pretty much they call Superman the big guy or him or the that dude. They don't, you know, it's very oblique references to Superman. But anyways, you know, you can cut that out. That's fine. but one thing I do want to say, actually, you know, it's interesting that you kind of went into that tangent because, without trying to go too far ahead into Arrow's timeline, DC is actually now stopping Arrow from playing with a lot of things. There was a storyline that they wanted to do with Harley Quinn that they've been rejected. They're no longer, I believe, allowed to go and talk about the Suicide Squad, which is what they had done before. Yeah. And there's no more Deathstroke. I'm pretty sure that's off limits to Arrow, the TV show as well. So I agree with you that for a time, they were allowed to do this kind of sandboxy kind of play with the characters. But now it's much more restricted, I think. It'll be interesting going forward, especially since the CW is growing, or DC, I should say, is growing their their TV universe. But their movie universe is growing exponentially as well. So now that they haven't been consistent with how they're going to handle that. So it'll be interesting to see once we have a big screen version of Flash and a small screen version of Flash, what's going to happen? We don't know.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting because just in general for them, you know, they have created a pretty big universe for themselves on TV and have a lot of things to play with already. You know, so even if you don't get to do all the Suicide Squad stuff at this moment right now, it's not necessarily necessary because there's still tons of other things they're playing with. And it doesn't really, I don't feel like it's going to feel too hampered. And who knows, after things settle down with that movie, they maybe get to play with some of those things again. And, you know, so that I think it just was the thing that really set them apart. And, you know, they've done a great job, I think, with just crafting that. And it's interesting. They're creating their whole own universe to play in, and it's really cool. I did want to ask real quick before we get off the actors and everything, because Paul Blackthorne and Colin Donnell plays Tommy Merlin, and then Paul Blackthorne plays Detective Lance. I wanted to ask you about them. And because they play a major role in this first season, especially.
His name just left me. You just said it. Who's just Paul. Been a lot of stuff. Yeah, I really like him. The guy who plays Tommy. I like him too. You know, he essentially gets coolered at the end of the season. but, you know, and again, for me, I didn't dislike his character. I didn't like his character, but he had a very specific role to play, which ends with him getting coolered, as I said. So there's a lack of depth, I think, for me with that character played against, you know, the great jobs of the other characters. Again, I don't think the guy did a bad job or anything like that. He just had a very, very specific trope role to play, and he played it very well, but that was kind of it for his character. But I do like the dad. I like the cop dad. and I enjoy that actor quite a bit. So I enjoy him.
I echo those sentiments exactly. I love Tommy. Was actually I didn't mind him. I thought he was good. Interesting kind of like I guess what you'd call them brillionaires. I don't like their best friend billionaires. I don't know how you would say that. I know that was kind of sloppy, but you know that was interesting for a little bit. And then I didn't you know he meets his fate at the end of the season. But I really do like Detective Lance a lot, even though his accent, which I knew was faked from the start, but I didn't know he has a like British accent. I think maybe
He does.
Yeah, which was like mind blowing to me when I first saw it. Because his fake, like, Bostonian-esque-ish accent always felt weird to me, but I love that character. He's, like, he's the Jim Gordon of the Arrow universe, and I think he does a great job. And he's actually one of my favorite characters on the whole show. I really, you know, just a man of conscience, kind of, like, trying to deal with these crazy situations happening. I really do like him a lot. And then his... his two daughters get involved in this whole situation. It's like, I feel for the guy for sure.
Well, one of the things that this show does from the very beginning of this season, and it just continues on to season 2 and 3, but this first series arc, they are going 100 miles a minute every episode. Like, every episode is pulling as much in and telling you as much story as possible. And they're really not pulling any punches. They're not doing that thing where I don't have to watch that episode on the rewatch. Like, all of the episodes have something to do with everything else that's happening. And, you know, that's the most important thing, I think, when you're creating a comic book TV show, especially like this, is it feels like a comic book series. It feels like the entire series you read in Arrow for a year, where all the issues fit together, and then when you read them all again, you see all the connections and everything. Like, this is masterful comic book storytelling on a level that, I mean, Smallville couldn't match at all, even at its best. I mean, this is the thing that I think really set people on fire with this show when they first kind of got into it, and then everybody was like, this is the show you should be watching. Like, Dana, you were saying, you read those articles of people saying, Arrow is the best show that you're not watching. Go watch it, you know, because they never pulled the punches, you know, and they just went a million miles a minute, and when you didn't think they were going to go there, they went there, and then they went 10 miles past that, you know, and that's such amazing storytelling, because in this ridiculous world that we live in where, you know, you maybe get 10 episodes to try and be a series and then you get canceled, I think these comic book shows realized you either go for broke or you get canceled. You know, you go big or you go home. And Arrow went big from the beginning and it just continued. And they obviously learned their lesson with Flash as well. You go big or you go home because you don't know how long you're going to be out there. So tell the stories that you want to tell now and figure out what you're going to do next season. Because just tell the best story you can every single season. And that's what I love about this first season arc, is that it's huge, it's expansive, and I never feel like if I'm watching one of the episodes, I'm like, oh man, I don't really, this is boring. Like, that just doesn't happen with Arrow.
So before we move off of actors, I would also like to mention, in terms of fan service, the amount of geek-tastic guest stars that season one is sort of amazing. and I, you know, I can't imagine that they actually did that on purpose. I'm sure they just hired who they thought would be best for the role. But man, you got John Crichton, you've got Sergio from Helix, you've got Halo from Battlestar Galactica. You know, I mean, the list just goes on and on.
I think that they've just kind of learned, and it feels like the people that are making these shows, and in a lot of the ways that I respond to the Star Wars cartoons we've had, like the Clone Wars and Rebels now,
I love
they're
Rebels.
Fans, you know, they know what we like, and even Greg Berlanti, I mean, he was talking about Supergirl. And he said, look, I've talked to the network. I want Supergirl to cross over with Flash and Arrow, because I'm just like you. I'm a huge fan. That's what I want to see. But there are some things that are out of his control, and so hopefully that'll happen. But I love that. I love that they have the passion as much as we do to see this stuff be the best. And I think, you know, that's what makes Arrow so successful its first season. And even in the rewatch that I did, I was surprised at just how well it all played out again, even though I'd seen it before, because there were still tons of things I was picking out that I just missed the first time around. Well, for you guys, before we go, anything else that just grabs you about the first season of Arrow that we didn't talk about? Things you liked or things you don't like? And then I guess we can go ahead and kind of give this a rating, especially as we're talking about the first season of a show that, well, is the basis for a universe now.
Well, we can't not talk about shipping in relationship to Arrow.
There you go. Yeah.
Because again, as I said, you know, for me, one of the temples of the Green Arrow universe is Black Canary and Green Arrow ending up together. And yet, because Felicity has such great chemistry with Stephen Amell, I was a Felicity shipper, as they're called, from very early on. And I saw Stephen Amell as a panel at Emerald City Comic Con last year. And he actually talked about it, because I cannot tell you how many people in the audience asked him about the Felicity ship and was anything really ever going to come to fruition of that. And he said that he kind of felt like it was his fault that Felicity shipping happened, because he remembered his experience on, God, I want to say some, what was the show about housewives in LA? Not reality TV, but like regular shows. Desperate Housewives. I think he had a guest role on that or something. So, well, anyway, some show.
Was he a pool boy?
I don't know. So some show he was on, and he just said that the female actors were just so gracious to him and made him feel so comfortable that it was a really awesome experience. And he said that he wanted to offer that experience to Emily, and in doing so he thinks perhaps that he exuded a little bit more charm and chemistry than perhaps was appropriate for the characters, which I thought was really sweet, frankly. So anyway, I think it's very interesting that there was such a response to that chemistry that, you know, in the Tumblr-verse and the Twitter-verse and, you know, fandom-verse in general, that people were like, oh no, F Black Canary, he needs to end up with Felicity, which I just thought was really fascinating.
I ship Felicity. I mean, I'm with you. I loved them together. And what it was is that it was two equals. You know, what I loved about the relationship that she has with Oliver is that she doesn't have to take his crap. You know, she doesn't have to be there if she doesn't want to. She chooses to be there. And I think in a lot of ways, too, what's so cool about her character is that she sees the man Oliver is trying to be, and she's the one who believes that he can be, even when he doesn't believe it. And I think that makes for a great kind of redemptive story of having that person that believes in you no matter what, even when you make the terrible mistakes that Oliver makes. And this is another great thing about Arrow, is that it's a show that allows the characters to make mistakes, but then they have to pay for them in the upcoming episodes. And that's what the entire show has been doing from season one all the way through season three, is that it has really been building on the decisions that the characters make to kind of tumble out. And that's one of the things that they do with the island and then with coming home, and it all plays together, and that life is interconnected. You make one decision and it, you know, the opposite and equal reaction happens, you know. So I think that's what I really loved about her and him together, is that she's the one who believes in him when he doesn't believe in him. And there's not really anything that's more powerful, I think, than as a man having that kind of woman by your side. And for the most of the time, I think it's great too, because he realizes he doesn't really deserve her. But that's not what love is. It's not about deserving. It's about being offered a kind of a free gift. And it's I really love how they play that. So I'm totally with you, Alice.
I will be the contrarian then, as I often am, and I'll try not to go too far outside here. But I am I guess you would call it a Bearicity shipper. Perhaps I believe that Felicity belongs with another CW superhero star. but that is not something we find out in the first season of Arrow, so I don't know how far into that we want to get. I'm just saying, I think she might have more chemistry with another DC superhero. That's all I'm going to say.
I'm just talking season one, Daniel. Season
one. I'm just saying there's, in the future, maybe she has more chemistry. It's all I'm saying. It's a possibility.
We're getting into that mission log territory where you're like, maybe someday if another superhero shows up.
Perhaps.
You know, perhaps. I don't know. But yeah, no, I mean, what I think is so great about the show again is that they have created so many just different opportunities for themselves by being good writers. In the same way that I think Deep Space Nine did, I don't think they always intentionally wrote things. I think they wrote good stories that they were able to then go back and use later on because they realized, oh, that's kind of genius. That can connect to this. I think that the Arrow writers are a little more interconnected, and they're definitely probably planning things out a lot more. But at the same time, I think they're just planting all these great seeds and seeing what happens. And with all great TV shows, who works best with each other, you know? That's the one thing I liked about this too, is that Alice, you have that question, would he end up with Black Canary or would he end up with Felicity? And this being their own show, they can go whichever way they want, you know? And because they're still paying homage to the Black Canary story, it doesn't necessarily have to end up at the same place. In the same way right now that DC in their Superman comics, it's not Lois and Clark, it's Clark and Diana. And they're
playing I thought you were going to say Lana.
No, they're playing out a completely different storyline there because, well, honestly, Lois and Clark's been done, you know, so show us something different. And so I think that's just one of those things where paying homage and doing your own thing, they've earned that. They're earning that right, I think, from us fans to be able to do that. And like you, you're all giddy about the fact that these two characters play so well together and you like them. You feel bad for being like, oh, but that's not how it plays out in the comics, but I don't care. You know, that's good and fun writing to me with a comic book TV show.
There was one thing I wanted to say. I know here we are on a Star Trek network, and I am one of the hosts of a Star Trek podcast. But I will say that to me, the television holy grail of science fiction is Battlestar, and while I won't hold Arrow quite up to that level, I will say that it does a lot of the same things that Battlestar does to get people who are not into the genre excited about the genre. It's fast paced. It doesn't relent. It's constantly in your face. It gets the people who are not exactly where we are most of the time, in regard to these kinds of properties, excited about watching them. And Arrow did that first, and maybe did it best. And it was, especially in season one, like, man, it was such a episode to episode, pound for pound, so good, so solid. It was just tremendous. And it in the same way that Captain America movies made me excited about a character I didn't really care for before, this made me excited for a character that I never had any connection to. I didn't care too much for Green Arrow. And now I'm like, whoa, what's going to happen? Well, now he gets to fight the Flash in this episode. I know that's later on down the road, but I was excited and he's like, now I'm a Green Arrow fan. I'm a fan of a guy running around in a Robin Hood costume and shooting arrows at bad guys.
Arrows are cool, Daniel. They're cool.
Katniss rules.
I might be behind the curve on that one. Maybe it's just me, but I really can't speak too positively about Arrow season one, for sure.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because when I was thinking about it, I thought to myself, it's so funny that you said it, because I thought to myself, like, you know, season one, Arrow is really, really good. Okay, it's not Battlestar good, but it's really good. So it's really funny to me that you brought that up.
Battlestar Galactica, I don't love the rest of the seasons, but that first season is one of the best seasons of television and one of the tightest plotted seasons of television I've ever seen. And talk about exciting. I mean, you literally...
edge of your seat.
The stupid Netflix is not going fast enough to get to the next episode, because it's... I mean, you really are on the edge of your seat with these characters. How are they going to survive? How are they going to get out of this? And Arrow takes what it means to be a comic book, and, you know, you maybe have 25 pages in a comic book to actually tell a story, and you need to do it quick, and you need to get to the point in the story. And the issues where you don't, you're like, man, that was $3.99. You know, like, even on my iPad, this is stupid. You get frustrated, but the Arrow learns the lesson and makes each episode important, just like you said with the Battlestar Galactica. I love that analogy. So, you know, for me, I'd rate this 4.5 out of 5 full quivers, because this is an amazing, I think, season and beginning of a rekindling of that love of comic book characters. And like you said, Daniel, it brought a character and the idea of comic book characters to people that maybe just that wasn't their thing. But now it's the thing, because have you seen that guy's abs?
Yeah, yeah. I was gonna say, can I give a rating? Because I didn't get to give one.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah. No, I'm definitely gonna give this a 32 pack. Actually, you know what? You know what? I'm gonna give it a full keg. This is a full keg of abs for everyone involved. So that's what I'm giving it.
Well, what would?
I don't think I can follow that up with anything. I mean, what am I gonna say?
Well, Alice, do you have a rating? I don't know if anybody can, like you said, top Daniel's rating, because
I whatever I come up with is just gonna sound weak by comparison. So oh my god. All right, how about 4.5 out of 5 shots between the eyes? I don't know.
That'll work. Yeah. And I what I love is that we can be so positive about something in geekdom. And I think that the first season of Arrow, specifically for a lot of people, you know, depending on what they thought of the other seasons, you know, this season I think was strong. And the fact that you had this kind of reaction, and it started a whole new movement on TV in a way that I think nobody was expecting. I mean, God, they're doing The Flash on TV now. I mean, they did Gorilla Grodd. They're doing Legends of Tomorrow with Rip Hunter and time travel and Firestorm. I mean, the things that we're getting, this is the geek golden age. So, and I think we kind of owe it to the fact that Arrow worked so well its first season. If it hadn't, we wouldn't be getting this stuff. So this show, no matter what happens in the next seasons, as we talk about those later on down the road here in the 602 Club, we owe a great debt to the work that the writers did. Greg Berlanti, Andrew Kinsborough, and the rest of the guys, nothing can be taken away from the work that these people did. It's fabulous. So it's been an absolute blast talking about Arrow with you guys. I've loved the fact that we've laughed so much, because that makes it so much more fun. But it's not the only thing that we have been talking about the past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
You know, watching it live to 3 months after the series ends to watch the Mirror Universe episodes.
You're like, whoa, man, I heard season 3 got dark, but this is crazy.
It got darkly.
Oh.
Earl Grey.
we divide the ship into one of two ways. Port goes to port. I better not see any starboard guys on the starboard phaser target practice. You guys know which side of the ship you're on.
The orb.
And so they cannot impart to him the knowledge that he needs in order to raise his son. And Worf doesn't want to raise a human son. Like you said earlier, he didn't get the son that he wanted. He wants to raise a Klingon son.
The ready room.
We knew that Spock was popular, and we knew that Dad had some fans, but we were not prepared for what we saw happening in the social media, in the print media. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the New York Times reported that they got more hits on Dad's obituary than any other personality in the history of the paper.
To the journey! You're not a member of our race or a member of our culture, so we're going to say no.
That's kind of boring, and yet I don't know what else to do.
Oh, screw you!
Sorry, buddy.
Warp 5.
I remember watching Broken Bow when Enterprise first debuted when I was in high school, and I remember revisiting it now in full, and I had forgotten the fact that Future Guy had actually played an integral role from the get-go with Silic and the Suliban, which we'll talk about later in the show.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
It's all of these top-notch filmmakers, like people like Walter Murch, who literally wrote the book on editing. Like those guys all teaming up to make a big action kids movie, I think is really cool.
The 602 Club.
I think he's very much recreating that THX feel, and you may disagree with it. You may not think it's, you know, it's great, but it's on purpose. He wants that world to be that way.
Let me just say, conceptually, I agree with that. In terms of execution, that's where I think he failed.
Literary Treks.
It's amazing to me, as I reread these stories, how much of it I just kind of think of as Deep Space Nine these days, even though it wasn't part of Deep Space Nine, you know, the actual series.
Axanar, the official podcast.
It is the spirit of TOS that matters that's being captured, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the aesthetic. The aesthetic was 1966 to 1969 that had its moment, it had its time, and there's a certain amount of charm still to that. But it doesn't allow you to push the narrative forward because that type of aesthetic holds creativity back, in my opinion.
Women at Warp.
So she definitely knows cats. I say that right off the bat.
She knows cats and Bones.
Yes, definitely. Of course Bones would get annoyed with all the cat fur.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Guys, check out these shows. Find out what we've been talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. Beyond, as Arrow would say. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you are an Apple user, guys, I was just looking at our stats the other day, and honestly, about 80% of people get their podcast from some kind of Apple usage, whether it's their iPhone or whether it's just their computer or iTunes. So the star ratings and reviews and all of that stuff do wonders for us. And really, it's you guys that are going to be the people that help us introduce Trek FM to people we'd never be able to find. So not only the star ratings and reviews, but man, share us on your social media. You know, you see us tweet that out or put that on Facebook. Share that with people, because if you love it, heck, other people will probably love it. And it's you guys that can help this network grow in a way that we never can. And we appreciate you so much. Guys, if you're not an Apple user, who cares? Because we've got the shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file. Get the RSS link at the website as well. One of the most important things that people that listen to the network can do can be to visit patreon.com/trekfm and learn how they can support the network. A lot of people, I don't think, realize just exactly what goes into producing a podcast. So I'm going to give you a quick rundown of what that takes. What goes into making a podcast is this. Usually we have to have a recording time, and we have to have the recording software, which costs money, and we have the platform that we record everything with. We use a GoToMeeting type thing, a thing called Zoom. So we all get together, we all record our audio. All that audio gets compiled and put together and edited together on some software. put all that together with the music and all that stuff to make it sound as good as we do, clean everything up, make sure it sounds good for you guys. That takes, you know, hours, if not more, to put all to that together. And then, of course, we put the artwork together. Then we put all that stuff together. And finally, the show has to get all put together and published on the website and all the different places that we do that. Richard helps me with that, making sure everything looks good. And then it finally gets published. And then we put it on social media. And that's when it comes out to you guys. There's a million other steps that happen. All of that stuff, it costs money, it takes time, and without you guys, we can't make that happen. And that's what's so important about Patreon.com. You can check out all the ways that you can support us financially, and you can see what we're trying to reach milestone-wise. And we've got some great perks for you. We are working on some amazing things just to come to Patreon supporters. I already have my associate producers who get your early access to content, though. You can get exclusive content. You can sit in our Patreon roundtables that we've been starting to do. And so go to patreon.com/trekfm. Look it all up. If you have any questions, just let one of us know. And we appreciate you guys so much, because honestly, without you, it's just not worth doing. And so I want to just say thank you, especially to Ken Tripp, who is my associate producer here on the 602 Club, as well as C. Brian Jones and Norman C. Lau, who are both my executive producers. If you would like to contact us, guys, I'd love to hear what you think of Arrow Season 1. Send us a contact, trek.fm/contact. You could leave us a voicemail. I'd love to hear your thoughts that way. Look in the sidebar on the show page. Just go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. We're on Twitter at trekfm, of course, or at Facebook, facebook.com/trekfm. Both of those places, great ways to share the shows with your friends on your social media, through your Twitter or your Facebook account. Great ways to help the shows grow. And of course, the Babel Conference, our listeners only discussion group, have so much fun talking to you guys there. Check us out. Search Babel in the Facebook search field, or go to the website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. Now, Daniel and Alice, I am so glad that you guys joined me tonight. I had a blast. Again, I love when you guys are on, and it means the world to me that you just take some time out to talk these geeky things with me, because otherwise I think listeners would be really bored just listening to me. But Alice, where can everybody find you online? And of course, tell them about Educating Geeks, a podcast they need to be listening to.
The podcast you're not listening to that you should be.
Exactly.
So we, I would, first of all, I would like to support what you said, Matthew, in terms of your, of people going to Patreon and supporting you guys. Cause you know, we've learned a lot from the folks here at Trek FM in terms of, you know, how to put together a good podcast and what it takes. And you may start out thinking that's this really easy, quick thing to do. And then once you get into it, you realize, oh my gosh, no, there's all of this work and equipment and whatnot that you need. So I'd really encourage you to get over there to Patreon and support these guys, because they do a really great job, and they deserve your support if you enjoy what they're doing. So I'm one of the executive producers of Educating Geeks, and much like the folks here in the 602 Club, we get together and talk about geeky things. What we like to do is to invite someone who has never experienced a piece of geekdom in to experience it for the first time, and then we have a discussion about what the first-timer's experience is against what the superfan's experience is. And we do that twice a week over at educatinggeeks.com.
Awesome. And like I said, if you're not listening to Educating Geeks, why? Because Daniel and I love it, and we give it our stamp of approval. So go check them out. Daniel, of course, tell everybody where they can find you on the network and online as well.
Yeah. And before I even do that, I will exactly echo Matthew's statements. Educating Geeks gets my stamp of approval as well. I'm a subscriber, and I love the show. So good. The ladies are awesome. They're talking about interesting things. It's amazing. So it's a great show. Everybody should listen to. But here on Trek FM, people can find me on Earl Grey, the next generation dedicated
the Latra.
The Star Trek The Next Generation dedicated podcast here on the network with my co-hosts Philip and Darren, where we talk TNG every week, and it's fantastic, and we love it. And you can find me there, and you can also find me on Twitter as well. And my handle there is OneUpDan, that is the number one, not the word.
Well, guys, of course, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. I do The Orb with Christopher Jones, where we talk exclusively about Deep Space Nine. Love doing that show with him. It's so much fun. I'm on Literary Treks with Dan, where we're talking about the books and the comics of Star Trek. In fact, it's the best place to get quote-unquote new Star Trek. We talk about the new comics that come out. We talk about the new books that come out. A lot of times we have the authors on to talk about those new books and get their thoughts on the creative process and kind of the behind the scenes. Check us out at Literary Treks. Dan and I love doing the show together. And then, of course, you can find me on my own personal blog at 42lifebetween.wordpress.com. I do movie reviews, book reviews, and things that, you know, just might not fit on, say, like a Trek FM style show. And just my own thoughts in general. So if you care at all, hit me up there and let me know what you think about some of the things that I've written. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. And you guys come back now. You hear?